How did you think of that? With Temple Grandin.
And I'm Sherry Quinn. On our final episode of Series 1, Grandin talks to Sarah Freeman, Utah State University Assistant Professor of Neurobiology.
Hello, it's an honor to be here.
Good to see you.
You too.
Freeman studies the biological underpinnings of social behavior and monogamy. Throughout her career, she has researched these common phenomena in humans, other primates, rodents, and more recently, coyotes. Studying social behavior in a variety of species helps scientists better understand the core of the social brain and how neurological circuits work for humans.
So if you think about studying animal behavior, it's an output of the brain. I mean, the brain controls so many different aspects of our body's function, but behavior is one quantifiable, very robust output of the brain. And so if you want to study the social brain, you can get a really good measure of that by just quantifying and measuring the social behavior of an animal.
She also has work underway to decipher how hormones of the brain, like oxytocin, may vary in neurodivergent individuals.
I have experience with prairie voles and TT monkeys, which are two different species of animal that form monogamous pair bonds. And yeah. We study these monogamous animals in order to determine what about their biology and hormones and brains are sort of underlying that ability to form a long-term selective attachment bond.
So what have you learned about the, in your research, what are some of the main things that you've learned about?
Well, I started when I was a graduate student at Emory University with Larry Young. I started out working on prairie voles, which are pretty common, more common now, more well-known animal model for studying the neuroscience of attachment. But I then sort of pivoted and carved out some space to look at the oxytocin receptors in the brains of monkeys. So brain tissue that we acquired opportunistically. So like when given the opportunity to take brain tissue from an animal that was already slated for euthanasia or who died of natural causes, we would take brain tissue and try to figure out where the social hormone oxytocin is acting in the brain, in the primate brain, because we didn't know. We only really understood the neurochemistry of the oxytocin system in rodents. And so my research found that in the brains of various non-human primates, different species of monkey, the oxytocin receptors are in visual parts of the brain. So the oxytocin hormone is acting in the circuits that govern visual attention. And in rodent brains, the oxytocin receptors are mostly in areas that are involved in the olfactory system. So sense of smell, and also in some of the memory circuits. And so it seems like over evolutionary time, the systems have kind of split so that oxytocin is acting in the visual parts of a primate brain and the olfactory parts of a rodent brain, which makes a lot of sense. Yeah, like how those classes of animals navigate their social environments, primarily relying on vision, but not entirely. We also use vocal cues, and some primates are scent marking, so they also use their sense of smell. But primarily, we use our eyes. Rodents are primarily navigating their social environments using their sense of smell. And so this social hormone seems to have, has its mark on the brain and these sensory modalities.
No, that's really interesting, you know, that different species make a priority for different senses.
Mm-hmm.
Real, real interesting that the rodents were smell. Rodents are animals that live in burrows too.
Mm-hmm.
So vision is going to be less important in that environment.
Right. And they all kind of look the same.
Well,
and
I
many
tell,
of them are nocturnal.
Well, so. Students, you want to understand how an animal might behave, look at what it does in the wild. And
absolutely.
I know that rodents spend a lot of time in burrows.
Absolutely.
That might emphasize smell. Of course, a dog's social life really revolves around smell.
Yeah, well, it's funny that you mentioned dogs, because here in my position at Utah State, I've been able to start a new branch of my research program studying coyotes, or coyotes, as folks around here like to say. There's a research facility not too far away from our campus that's run by the USDA, and most of their research relies on better understanding human predator conflicts. So coyotes being mostly treated as a pest animal that, you know, is causing problems with livestock and yeah. ranchers and, you know, different types of issues around here up in rural northern Utah, you know, agricultural, I should say. And I've been able to come in and study coyotes in their social behavior because they are also monogamous and form social bonds. And so we've been able to do some work to kind of set some of the foundations. I'm only in my third year as an assistant professor, so things are still starting to grow, but we're looking at their brains and their hormones and their behavior to see how coyotes as a sort of representative from the canine family might compare to what we already know from rodents and primates.
So I'm going to probably assume that the smell would be a very dominant.
Yeah, they're also very visually vigilant to their surroundings too. They scan their territories and they're very aware of especially humans in their environment.
Oh, yeah, but also things that might be a threat. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so
I understand that.
Yeah, we actually have done some work to look for oxytocin receptors in their brains and do see quite a lot in the olfactory system too, which is pretty fascinating.
Well, you see, look at what they do in their environment. And when I worked on animals in translation years ago, I covered the work, I'll never pronounce the name correctly, Solodonix, who studied prairie dogs. And they actually had calls that had a noun-like function, a description function, and an urgency function. And I thought that's really interesting. And when I talk to people about animal behavior, I always tell vet students and animal science students, animals live in a sensory-based world. You've got to get away from verbal language. And I'm kind of surprised that we still have a lot of people discussing whether or not animals are conscious. And I think some of this gets down to whether you think in words or you think in pictures. And I think in pictures, so it's obvious to me, you don't have to have language to be conscious.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
In animal behavior, being able to not think verbally, I think, is a benefit in animal behavior.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think if you can sort of put yourself in the shoes, if you will, of the study That's organism right. you're working with, then you can really benefit from that. The level of imagination required to be able to put yourself in that space and imagine, you know, what would the behavioral ecology of that species look like, and how can I design an experiment to ask a question about an animal's cognitive abilities or behavioral motivations and do it in a way that really speaks to the natural behavior of that species.
As Raymond mentioned, she's added coyotes to her mammalian research toolbox to answer these broader questions. When compared to other species she studies, canids are the experts when it comes to monogamy. At the Coyote Research Facility in Millvale, Utah, the coyotes are kept in large outdoor enclosures in a setting that mimics the natural environment as much as possible.
One of the things that, you know, I kind of realized in establishing this program is that, you know, I've been studying monogamy and pair bonding for my whole career now, and we've always used rodent and non-human primate models. Primates are more closely related to humans, and so we can make, you know, a little bit more sort of inferences about human biology from studying monkeys. But either way, the rodents, I think it's in mammals, like 3 to 5% have a monogamous mating system. In primates, I think it's a little higher, maybe 20%. But in canids, every single wild species of canid that's been studied so far is capable of forming pair bonds, at least in some environments. So in that class of animals, pair bonding and attachment and monogamy is the rule. But in all of the species that we've been studying so far, monogamy is the exception to the rule. So I'm hoping that by adding this additional group of organisms to the, you know, greater swath of literature on the biology of pair bonding, we can be able to better kind of fill that gap by saying, okay, these things that we've discovered in one species of rodent is true across lots of different mammals or not, for example. So maybe some of the phenomena and some of these systems that we've been targeting and claiming are applying to humans and all these different mammals and birds as well. Some of the same sort of analogous hormone systems are important in non-mammalian vertebrates too. So by studying coyotes, I'm hoping to kind of add another piece of the puzzle, not just to, you know, the sort of comparative mammalian neurobiology of attachment, but also what we were talking about earlier, to find out whether or not oxytocin is acting in the parts of the brain that govern the sensory modality that that animal uses to navigate social space. So coyotes add this other flavor because they are both visual and olfactory in the way that they navigate space, and very vocal as well. So they have an auditory component to the way that they maintain territories and communicate with others.
The other thing that'd be interesting is within a species, how much variation you have.
Right. Oh my gosh.
That article that was front page science on a dog behavior and things like trainability. They call it bitability or something like that. Border collies were the most trainable, but there also was a lot of variation within a breed of, of dog. And then they also looked at things like frightening stimuli. That breed of dog had a lot less effect on that. The thing I've always observed, when you just take something like Angus cattle, there's huge variability. Back 25 years ago, I started temperament testing in cattle. And the cattle we had 25 years ago, a lot wilder than the cattle we've got now. Because we've been doing over 20 years of selecting for gentler cattle.
Right.
And it's still the same breed of cattle, but we've changed them.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Animals that come rearing out of the top of your handling facility, they get people sell those.
Right.
Don't keep those.
Yeah.
And also there's been formal temperament testing with things like how much they struggle in a squeeze chute and what's called exit speed scoring. You either do it like walk, trot, canter, or use electronic device to time the exit speed. But I didn't realize how much we had changed Angus cattle until about 5 years ago. They used some new semen at our experiment station. And I got a steer in my lab. I'm gonna call them the time machine. This steer was completely crazy compared to our other Angus cattle.
Wow.
And it was strictly where the semen came from, and they never used any of that semen ever again. And he'd be trying to break out of the cattle handling facility while the other cattle just stood there calmly while he's jumping all around.
Wow.
I mean, it was totally obvious, the difference. And I'd kind of forgotten how wild it used to be. That's why I call him the time machine. Because he took me back to, you know, when it first started, you know, we've really tamed these animals down.
For sure.
And they're the same breed. They're Angus cattle.
Right. It's almost like a strain difference. We have a lot of individual variability in the coyotes that we've been studying so far. And it does pose some statistical challenges dealing with you know, data that's got a lot of variability within it. But I think from a scientific standpoint, I would rather work with species that have a lot of variability, because then you can actually try to find out what's driving that wide variety of differences in the measurements that you're taking, rather than relying on like an inbred strain of lab mouse where they're all
that's the problem.
It's clones of each other.
That's the problem. I read a fascinating paper called Solitary Mammals as a Model for Autism. Solitary Mammals as a Model for Autism. I think the author was Reiser, R-E-S-E-R. And he looked at the cat family. Mm-hmm. Lions are more social than panthers or leopards. Mm-hmm. And there's crossover with autism. Oxytocin. Yeah, you need to get this paper.
Solitary
mammals as a model for autism. And there's crossover here. And this is just variation in the cat family. And I talk about that all the time at autism meetings. I said, even though the autistic kid's less social, well, it's like the panther. Are leopards and panthers got a disability?
You see,
there's a certain range here where it's just variation. But the other interesting thing that's being found is that genetics in animals that's involved with normal behavioral variation is associated with disorders in people.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Which I think is really, really interesting. You know, building a big brain's a messy proposition.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's nice to hear that there's folks studying big cats as well, now that I'm like dipping my toes into the carnivore.
Well, they looked at a lot of different animals. The reason why I bring up the cat family when I discuss it is people know lions, and they know lions are social, and people know that leopards and panthers and mountain lions are somewhat solitary. you know, the autistic person tends to have, be more solitary, but they really get into what they do. Mm-hmm. And when I tell educators about that paper, they go, wow.
Freeman does not limit her research to non-human animals. She also works with human brain tissue that has been donated post-mortem to look at the oxytocin system in the human brain.
And I have developed a method to reliably visualize and quantify the amounts of oxytocin receptors present in the brain of humans. And one of the studies that I published recently, actually, I guess it's been a few years now, looked at donated brain tissue from individuals who had autism spectrum disorder while they were alive. And then we matched on age, sex, race, as best we could with some brain tissue from donors that did not have autism that were considered neurotypical or unaffected controls. And what we found in two different parts of the brain, we found differences. And one of those parts of the brain is called the ventral pallidum. It's a part of the brain's reward circuitry. And we found that individuals that had autism had lower levels of oxytocin receptors in that reward area compared to their matched control specimens. And which is interesting because you might think that having lower levels of receptors for oxytocin in a reward area might, this is hand wavy and speculative, but it might underlie potentially a reduced experience of reward or sort of pleasure or enjoyment from social interactions, perhaps. I am not on the spectrum, and so I cannot speak to the lived experiences of folks on the spectrum.
Let's look at it this way. Social sort of chit chat. I see people, they go out to a restaurant, four people chit-chatting back and forth, very rapid, which I have a hard time following, having such a good time, very little content in the talk, where a person with autism is more likely to get friends who shared interests, mm-hmm. where we can talk about horses, we can talk about animal behavior, I can talk about concrete forming systems, things that I find really interesting, and I'm not going to be as social just for the sake of social. One of the problems I have is my processor speed's not fast enough to follow mm-hmm. these chit-chat conversations. So I interrupt all the time, and I know I do this. And the reason I do it is I can't figure out exactly that my timing is too slow.
Oh, I think that happens to lots of folks as well.
Well, I think the whole thing is a continuum. And there's a point mild autism is just a personality variant, like the panther or the leopard. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, if you have speech delay, yes, that's definitely abnormal. Right.
Well, it's interesting that you talked about the sort of navigating and processing all that social information too, because the other region in the brain that we saw differences in the densities of the receptors for oxytocin is this part of the basal forebrain that's really important in sustained attention. It's called the nucleus basalis of Meynert, and it's a really important area that sort of controls a lot of cortical processing of sensory input. And so what other researchers have found is that that area is really important for maintaining selective attention on something. And we found that individuals with autism have higher levels of oxytocin receptors in that area. And so in the sort of speculative, what does that mean explanation, I was thinking that it might sort of sensitize the brains of individuals with autism to incoming social information, which might underlie some of the self-reports of being sort of overwhelmed.
The sensory problems are real. I've got some auditory processing problems. I can't hear when the background noise is too bad. It's always been that way. The other thing is we got to look at what's the sample you got those brains from. Mm-hmm. Were they the more Asperger type where there's no speech delay, socially awkward like Elon Musk? Were they nonverbal individuals? And then there's some individuals where they have an autism label, but I don't even think it's correct. I think they had enough other medical stuff wrong with them that shouldn't be the label.
Right, right.
So I want to look at what was the, some of the profile of those individuals.
Yeah.
Were they fully verbal, for example?
Right. Yeah, they were. I believe they were, although we only have the it's called the Autism Diagnostic Inventory Revise, the ADIR scales. So this is a measurement of the symptom severity of the symptoms of autism. And we have information from a subset of those donated specimens where we have the actual degrees of symptom severity. And we didn't see any correlation across the like main outcome measures, but we did look for that and control for that.
Similar to the way Grandin visualizes her designs and then puts them on paper, Freeman says she now likes to first draw out her experiments and see them before implementing them. Sounds a lot like the process of an artist.
There's so much creativity in science. I think a lot of people, you know, they like to think of science as this, maybe not rigid, but just that there's a right and a wrong, and that you do these experiments and you make sure you've got your appropriate controls and all of that. But it's not this split where it's like the arts are creative and science and technology and engineering and math are not. Because if you think about the STEM fields, we are creating new knowledge. We are generating information. Yeah. And we're doing so in a way that relies a lot on troubleshooting. And I think troubleshooting is a creative process.
Well, that's right.
So inherently creative. So I think we don't give the sciences enough credit for the creativity required to be successful and to be really innovative. And then in the arts too, they often are working with materials and have to understand the chemistry of like different glazes, if you're working in ceramics, right, for example. And I mean, you're really becoming kind of a materials expert in a lot of visual arts fields. So by stereotyping these two disciplines, I think you really...
Well, I would agree with that. There was a study actually done that showed that a scientist that a creative hobby was more likely to win a Nobel Prize. I think we've talked about a lot of really interesting things.
Yeah, me too. This has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for including me and for your time this morning, Temple. It's really an honor to get to chat with you one-on-one. Good luck with your new book. I'll check it out.
Well, I'm going to leave the meeting, and it was great to be here.
That was Temple Grandin and neurobiologist Sarah Freeman. This concludes Series 1 of How'd You Think of That with Temple Grandin.
Thank you so much for listening.
You can hear all the episodes online at stem.utah.gov/podcast. Original music compositions by Rebecca Baker and the USU Music Department. How'd You Think of That is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center in partnership with SQ Productions. Episodes are produced by myself and Jolene Bailey, with consulting and production assistance from Rosalie Winard. Thanks to Caroline Long for lending us a sound clip for this episode. Keep an ear out for Season 2.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grant number 174567.